Hello. In this audio snippet, again, we were planning on continuing with our meditation on Black America, and the subject that's pending is the issue of the annexation of Santo Domingo that created a split in the Republican Party during the time of Ulysses S. Grant, and how that had an indirect effect on the things that followed afterwards, and then, in a sense, it also affected what happened with Black America in the decades that followed. But I believe that we won't be able to get to that because we need to talk about other things that are happening at this time. And as we always say, as we've shared before, even though these things seem completely unrelated, I do believe they fall into the bigger picture of Black America. Because, as we've also said multiple times before, Black America had this calling to be the sentinels, the men on the walking along the watch, all along the watchtower, seeing what was ahead. And telling the rest of the nation what to prepare for and how to deal with what was coming. But Black America was too trapped in the slavery that the white liberal has placed her in, and too comfortable in her own cultural decay and demise. And that's the kind of the pig pen that the white fascist liberal has placed around Black America. And Black America was very happy in the squalor of that pig pen and was too busy doing its thing to be doing its job. And that had a lot to do with the demise of the country. Had Black America spoken out and allowed the voice of truth to speak through her? In other words, had she been willing to hear the truth that was willing to speak to her ear, and had she then spoken out the truth, I believe things would have been very different because Black America had a sway that no one else had, and they squandered it. So a lot of these things seem completely unrelated to the topic of Black America, but it is related to it in a very profound way behind the surface. So we wanted to go over several things that we more or less forgot to mention in other audio snippets, but I believe they're relevant and they need to be shared. And you'll see how they form like a big picture of things, of what is happening right now. So the first thing I wanted to share is something I forgot to mention, maybe a couple of snippets, audio snippets ago, and it was the fact that the Buffalo Cincinnati game. In the NFL, the one that got suspended was never finished. And that was the game where that black player, who I believe was 24 years old, Damar Hamlin, had his heart attack, and his he was almost dead on the field, but miraculously recovered. But the game was completely suspended. It was never finished, and I don't remember this ever happening. Maybe I could be wrong. Maybe it has happened before in the history of the NFL, of American football, of professional football in the NFL. But I don't recall it. I've never heard of anything anywhere close to it. And as I mentioned before, there was a commentator who was talking about how unusual that was, And he was criticized immediately by all the trolls in you know, what they call, quote, social media, because he was being insensitive. But he was just pointing out the reality that this was unprecedented. There have been games where people have been paralyzed for the rest of their lives, and they cart them off the field, and they continue playing the game. I mean, that's how it's always been, and this one was so different that they not only stopped the game for an extended period of time, but they carted him off, and they said, "We're not going to play anymore." And that is very significant. And it's significant because it was like immediately after the snippet where we talked about the World Cup, the one that was played in that hellish country, Qatar, that we said that the World Cup ended at the end of extra time when France and the Hispanics were tied 3-3. And that everything that happened afterwards, the penalty kicks and all that, it doesn't exist. It's irrelevant. It's like it was never played. And when I was saying that, that sounded so strange, such a strange thing to say, but that was the reality. Nothing after that 3-3 tie will ever matter in FIFA World Cup tournaments. It just doesn't matter anymore. It's over. And some might say, oh, that's just you're a fanatic and your team didn't win, and because of that you're kind of like closing your eyes and pretending like nothing happened after the extra time because it wasn't to your liking, and you're just going to pretend, you know, like it didn't happen because you're so fanatical, but that's not it. And the fact that immediately afterwards there was a game in the NFL that was never finished, and it was not a meaningless game. It was not like a game between two teams that are not making the playoffs, or a game where one of the teams has already made the playoffs and the other one is already eliminated, so they are not even. No one is concerned about who wins and who loses. That was not the game at all. And I just found out about this maybe a few hours before this recording, because I don't follow the NFL anymore for reasons too long to explain. Several years ago, I decided to boycott the NFL, following the NFL for 1 year, for one thing that's too long to explain. And I said, I'm going to wait 1 year, and then I'm going to follow it again. And then when I was about to follow it again, something happened. I don't remember. But then eventually I said, I'm going to follow them now. And they started doing their kneeling thing, you know, to do the BLM nonsense on the field and kneeling during the national anthem and all that. That's when I said, okay, I'm not going to watch them anymore. So I used to follow the NFL, the National Football League, very closely here in America, but not anymore. So all these things I'm finding out, having to find out kind of manually, you could say. So I didn't know that this game between Buffalo and Cincinnati was very relevant. Buffalo was 12-3 at the time. And the Cincinnati Bengals, I think, were 11-4 or something like that. So they were two of the three top teams in the American Football Conference in terms of record. And that's very important going into the playoffs because that decides home field advantage. So in the NFL, when the regular season ends, then you have you rank the teams are ranked, like who got the best record, who got the second best record, and so forth. And they're like seeds in a tennis tournament, you know, the number one seed, the number two seed, and so forth. So based on that, they decide when they play. And the best teams, at least in the past, and in the old format, as I knew it before, I don't know if it's changed, the best two teams get the first playoff week off. so they don't have to play the first week, and then they play the next week, and they host whoever won, and so forth. So they have home field advantage as long as they continue to win. So it's very important teams vie for that position. And Buffalo and Cincinnati were two of the three best teams in the AFC, and they were very close to each other. And the other team was the Kansas City Chiefs. And they were all like within one or two games of each other. And this was the second to last game of the season. So it was all very important. And the fact that it was suspended was very relevant. And it's interesting that they decided a few days after the game. The NFL decided that they were not going to replay the game because that would have caused a lot of problems. It would have caused a delay in the playoffs, starting the playoffs 1 week late, and it would also and also they said the game, based on the mathematics of all the possible results, does not affect in any way who makes the playoffs and who doesn't. So in that sense, it has no consequence, but it has a consequence in terms of it had a con possible consequence in terms of seeding. So they kind of made a compromise. They said, we're not going to play that game anymore, but we are going to do something where if the the potential number one seed, if the Bills or the Bengals make it play against the Chiefs, for example. And there's uncertainty on who would have been the number one seed had this game been finished, then the game's going to be played in a neutral site, which is going to completely crazy and strange. But the reason why I'm sharing all of this is to emphasize that the game was very relevant, and relevant as it was, it wasn't finished that day, and it will never be finished. The NFL decided a few days later, we will never finish this game. And that, to me, as I thought about it, was like a confirmation. Okay, like I was saying this crazy thing about the World Cup ending undecided with a 3-3 tie, and then immediately afterwards in the NFL we have a game, a very relevant game, that never gets finished. And at the end of the day, it turns out Kansas City became the number one seed with a 14-3 record. I didn't even know they play 17 games now in a season. It used to be 16. And then the Bills ended with a 13-3 record, playing only 16 games because they missed this game. And the Bengals ended up 12-4. So they were all within one game of each other, one or two games of each other. But now there's this uncertainty that had Buffalo won against Cincinnati, they would have also been 14-3. So who knows who would have been the number one seed? So now if Buffalo and Cincinnati end up playing in the playoffs, then they will, I'm sorry, Buffalo and Kansas City, then they will have to play in a neutral site, which is very strange. So I just wanted to emphasize that we are in a situation, not just in the World Cup or in an NFL game, where we are in a game that was never finished. And that's what's happening with America. America played a game, you could say, for 200 plus years, and we were close to finishing and conquering and achieving the fullness of our destiny, but we decided not to finish it. We said we don't want to finish it, and we're going to do everything in our power to not finish this game. And that's basically what America has done. It's gone out of its way to not finish the game, and so it's the game that never ended. And so that's kind of the theme of everything going on right now. And also, interestingly enough, Buffalo and Cincinnati are two teams that have been in the Super Bowl a combined six or sorry, seven times, if I'm not mistaken. Buffalo was in the Super Bowl 4 years in a row, lost all four times, and Cincinnati was in the Super Bowl. The first year I began to follow the NFL faithfully, interestingly enough, they lost in a close game in Detroit in the Superdome against San Francisco, the 49ers. And then I think in Super Bowl 23, if I'm not mistaken, a few years later, they played again. They reached the Super Bowl again, played the San Francisco 49ers, and lost again by a very close score in the last second, or last minute, you could say. San Francisco came from behind and won that game or something like that. And I believe they played in the last Super Bowl, but since I don't follow them anymore, I think they played against the Rams and lost in the last Super Bowl. And again, so the Los Angeles Rams, so they played against another California team and lost again. Interesting. San Francisco and Los Angeles, the two cities against which they have played. So what I'm trying to say is these two teams are perennial losers when it comes to the big game. So Buffalo has never been able to get over the hump and win that big game at the end. And neither has Cincinnati. Cincinnati came very close twice. And I don't know how close they came in this last Super Bowl. I don't even know the score. Don't know how it happened. I have no idea. I think it was a close game. I'm not sure. I have no idea. But the thing is that they represent the teams that don't win the big game, that never cross the Jordan and reach the promised land. And speaking of that, one thing that I wanted to mention that I failed to mention last time, maybe there was a purpose in me forgetting about it, was that we had this big debate or conflict over who was going to be the Speaker of the House here in the U.S. And we talked about that and how the traitor and whore Kevin McCarthy was nominated, and certain GOP or certain Republican representatives were fighting to prevent him becoming Speaker unless he submitted to certain conditions. And the thing I wanted to mention is that a lot of people wanted another candidate to kind of vie for this position of Speaker, and the name of the guy was Jim Jordan. And apparently I don't like him too much. I don't know much about him. I don't even know what state he is from. I have no idea. But the few times I've seen his picture, there's something about him that bothers me. But apparently this guy is a lot closer to the conservative values than the rhino Kevin McCarthy. So a lot of people wanted him, and he might have been a better speaker, a more honest and truthful speaker instead of this opportunistic political animal, Kevin McCarthy. He was offered the chance, like saying, do you want to be the speaker? And if you are, then we will nominate you and support your candidacy. But apparently he said he didn't want to be the speaker. He chose not to be the speaker. And I saw some headlines, some articles about how disappointing it was that he didn't step up, that he kind of cowardly, move back, probably because he didn't want to get in conflict with the Republican Party machinery and the big head honchos in the party. So he didn't want to alienate or anger the party elites, and that's why he kind of let Kevin McCarthy try to run for Speaker on his own. And the fact that he kind of stepped aside and didn't step up and try to be the leader of the party and the Congress, the Republican Congress, is kind of fitting, because we had an audio snippet on the 31st of December, I think a couple of snippets ago, called the Jordan Non-Crossers. We talked about the people who get close to the River Jordan, but don't cross it to enter and conquer the promised land. So then, interesting, fittingly enough, there was a Jim Jordan who said, "I will not. I don't want to be speakers." Like, and that's a figure of how we as a nation have taken that attitude of not wanting to cross the River Jordan. And some of us individually crossed the Jordan and kept trying to get all our fellow Americans to cross, you know, waving at them from the other side, saying, "Come, come, come." But they said, "Who the hell are you? Who the hell are you? We don't know who you are. We don't trust you." And they said, "No, our founding fathers, our Constitution is here on this side of the Jordan. We don't want to go there. So I don't know who you are. Please go away. We're fine on this side." And America never crossed. So, and the fact that this Jim Jordan didn't step up to a position of leadership is a reflection of that, that we are a nation that never, that chose not to cross the Jordan. And the a third thing I wanted to mention that we hadn't, that I forgot to mention before was this story about about a Moorish invasion. I saw this article. The story was dated 30th of December, and we had an audio snippet that was fittingly entitled "The Tolerated Moorish Invasion." That was a couple of audio snippets ago, I think. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about Morocco and the World Cup and all this, and how the Moroccans were rioting in Europe, and how that's a reflection of the Moors who invaded. And we talked about how the Moors invaded Spain and Portugal and controlled most and sometimes a part of it for like 700 years or something to that effect, like 7 centuries, a long time, and how Morocco defeated both Spain and Portugal in the World Cup. And we spoke about how that's a reflection also of how we are being invaded in America from Latin America, the Moorish invasion in that sense. So we spoke about all those things, and we called it the Tolerated Moorish Invasion. And I was surprised, that's a few days later, less than a week later, this story came out, and I saw the link on this conservative web page that has links to different stories. And I find it interesting that they chose to put this story there. It's as if it was there as a confirmation, you know, without them knowing, like a confirmation that yes, what we were talking about is relevant. And I'm going to, there's a story so strange, I can't describe it without actually reading from the article itself. And I'm going to read portions of the article. They are from a website. It's en.hespress.com. So n.hespress.com. So it's en as in English dot. Instead of express, it's Hespress, HESPRESS.com. And so I'm going to go to that website. And I really don't know what this website is about, but the link kind of sent you to this article. So I'm going to start reading it. It says, "Moorish Americans are currently the subject of unprecedented negative attention in southern Maryland, U.S., after they engaged in loud shootings, endangering cows, and a stray bullet that punctured a neighbor's property," reports the Washington Post. Before authorities judged it necessary to stop the gun activities at the site, the events occurred in a previously gun-friendly, quote, location, where gun enthusiasts assembled. Those enthusiasts started calling themselves, quote, "Moorish Americans," an offshoot of the extremist sovereign citizen movement whose members believe they are immune from dealings with U.S. legal and financial systems, essentially took over the range, declaring it protected under the consular jurisdiction of Morocco, said the Washington Post. So I'm going to continue reading. Following repeated complaints from neighbors, authorities began to take action, finding the shooters and arresting them, until finally the property was raided by the sheriff's deputy, confiscating roughly a dozen firearms. One of the neighbors told the Washington Post that this intervention was long overdue. He described how he was worried about his herd of cows, which is why he moved them to a pasture where they wouldn't be shot at. While being handcuffed by law enforcement, Byron Bell, the landlord of the property where the gun enthusiasts assembled, had acknowledged that things had gone too far. Judge Karen Abrams said that the shootings, quote, encourage citizens to ignore the very regulations that are implemented to protect them and others, unquote. Officials from Charles County were faced with many perplexing documents to fill in from the Moorish group following the arrests. The officials stated that the terms of an 1836 treaty between the United States and Morocco, quote, apply to the dispute over Bell's territory where no special shooting license was provided. A, quote, writ of error signed by Lamont Morris L., who claimed to be the general consul of the, quote, Morocco Consular Court in the Maryland State Republic, unquote, was one of the papers. According to the Washington Post, the Moorish Americans think that they are the descendants of an imaginary empire that they claim once extended from the modern-day monarchy of Morocco to North America, with Mexico and Atlantis thrown in for good measure. I'm sorry. They assert their rights to seize houses that they claim are still a part of the, quote, Moroccan Empire, including well-appointed mansions owned by other people, while also claiming the same safeguards from U.S. judicial processes provided to foreign citizens. Court records show that Bell, the property owner, renounced his Moorish citizenship in September. He admitted to the Post that, although still having trouble grasping much of the group's doctrine, he found it to be, quote, very educational. One of the things he had discovered, he stated, was that he should regard himself as immune from the county's legal actions, in part because authorities from the government did not use the Moorish version of his name, Byron David Bell Bay, in court documents. The Moorish group promised shooters at the assembly, after charging them $25 a person, that, quote, security will be in full force for everyone's safety and protection, unquote, under Moroccan consular jurisdiction. Bell is now facing serious legal actions and is held with no bail possibility. He promised that there will be no more shootings at his property. So if you want to read the story, because I went through it, it's kind of difficult to follow, so I just read it very quickly. You can do a search on the title, Moorish Americans Under Scrutiny After Taking Over Shooting Range. And if you search for that title, Moorish Americans Under Scrutiny, you can search for that term only, and I think you will find this article almost directly at the top, near the top of the search results. And there's a picture of a black guy, and these are black people. There's a black guy wearing military attire, and he has the Moroccan flag in the back. You know, the flag with the red background and a green five-point star. And I know this sounds funny, but a lot of this has a lot of relevance. Interesting that these guys talk about a Moroccan empire that expanded into North America. And that's a figure. That's like almost like a confirmation of the Moorish invasion that has hit America, even though it's not in the form of literal Moors coming, but it's coming through other people. People who are Hispanics, and the Moors invaded Spain. You see the connection, how it's all interrelated. And so the thing is that to me, this was a validation that statement about the Moorish invasion is not just the product of our imagination. There's a reality to it, if you can call it a metaphysical reality to it. And these people catch, and they sound like crazy people, and they, in a sense, are. But these people are tuning into things. They just don't understand what they're tuning into. And they translate it in their own twisted way. But they are reflecting a reality that is there. They are Moorish invaders. And they claim to have authority over a land that's not theirs. Just like the Moors did when they went into the Iberian Peninsula. Just like the Hispanics do when they come to America. And they take what is not theirs. And they claim a jurisdiction that they don't have. So I just wanted to mention that thing. So that was the third thing I wanted to talk about. And after that, also, I wanted to make a correction. That would be the fourth thing. And that will take us into what some of the things I wanted to mention later. I wanted to make a correction about Brazil. I said at some point, I don't know why, and the moment I said it, I knew it didn't sound right. And I said something like Brazil's official name is something like Estados Unidos do Brasil. And I said, no, that doesn't sound right because Estados Unidos sounds very Spanish. It doesn't sound Portuguese. And that's why I immediately said, I think I'm making this up. But I said this before when things were still unclear about the situation in Brazil, and then I realized, okay, there was a purpose to that quote mistake, because I was giving attributing kind of a Spanish name to a Portuguese Brazilian country. And it was half Spanish and half Brazilian. You know, Estados Unidos, that was the Spanish part. And do Brasil would be the Portuguese part of Brazil. That what I think it would mean in English. But I think that has significance because, in a sense, now that the bastard communist Lula has taken over, it's as if the invasion of the Hispanic culture has permeated Brazil, the entire, as we've said before, all the Spanish-speaking countries are lost. They died. Most of them died in 2003, June 29th, and Argentina and Uruguay died in 2000. I believe it was between 2010 and 2014. They died. I don't know the exact date, but they died during that period. So the only country left in all of Latin America that had any hope of achieving anything lasting was Brazil. They were the last of the Mohicans, shall we say. And now with this, it seems like it's threatening the destiny of Brazil. And that's why they're now like halfway between being relegated to the same fate as the Hispanic Americans. They're between that and their destiny. So that's like they have this figurative name now of Estados Unidos do Brasil. And what I do know is that Mexico, their official name is Estados Unidos Mexicanos, which means Mexican United States. So it's as if they're kind of turned like half Mexican and they still have a little bit of Brazil in them. And I just wanted to point that out. I think their official name is something like, and I'm not pronouncing it right, I guess, but it's something like República Federativa do Brasil, which I think means Federative Republic of Brazil. And what I did want to point out when I was saying that phrase is that they have a federal system. That's what I wanted to mention, that they have 26 states. They call them states. And they have a very federal, very strong federal system, kind of like what we have in America. And that's part of the problem, too, with them. I just wanted to point that out. But before talking about Brazil, I did feel I... let's talk about Brazil. I wanted to jump to something else, but I think it's important to talk about Brazil right now. As you may know, things started getting a little bit rough in Brazil because the people of Brazil are upset that they had their democracy and their election stolen from them, and they began to protest. And as we mentioned before, Bolsonaro bolted out of Brazil and went to Florida like a coward, and left the Brazilian people to fend for themselves. And the people of Brazil got so upset that people, I didn't know this until a few hours ago. I didn't realize this because no one's talking about this. 8 million people, apparently, 8 million people from all over Brazil gathered in Brasilia. That's the capital of Brazil. In Brasilia to protest against Lula. 8 million people. Can you imagine that? 8 million people gathering. That's larger than, I don't know how many people are in New York anymore, but there are many countries in the world that have less than 8 million people, but 8 million people gathered in Brasilia. And remember, Brazil is a huge country. So who knows and they came apparently from all different states. So they must have traveled all the effort that they made to make it to Brasilia, to congregate in Brasilia, to protest. They had these massive protests. I'm going to read, and it was so bad that Lula, the chief thief, had to flee Brasilia and fly to São Paulo. He got away from Brasilia because he was afraid that something bad might happen to him. So he left while the protesters basically took over Brasilia. And in the quote, there's a quote in the article that I read when this story came out, that caught my attention when I read it that day. And I looked it up and I copy pasted it here to remember it, because it caught my attention when I saw it. And the quote says, this was from thegatewaypundit.com. That's where they posted this story talking about this. They didn't mention, if I'm not mistaken, the 8 million people at the time, but I found that out later. But the quote said, the protesters have taken over the seats of Congress, the president, and the Supreme Court of Brazil. So basically it talks about taking over the legislative branch, the Congress, the executive branch, the president, and the Supreme Court of Brazil, the judicial branch. And to me, the symbolism of that was the protesters were, in a basic sense, saying, we are against the system. Against the system that we have here in Brasilia, it has failed us, and we are coming against it. And to me, that was a subtle way of Brazilians kind of having this subtle awareness that there's something wrong with the system that they have. I could be wrong on this, but that was a sense I had. And again, the fact that 8 million people gathered there just emphasizes what a different reaction from America. The protests on January 6th, 2021 were pretty big. I think a million people might have gathered in Washington, D.C., but it was a million people compared to 8 million people. And America's and Brazil's populations are similar. I think they both hover around, I could be wrong on this, around 300 million people, both of them. Brazil might have fewer people, but not by much. I don't think Brazil has more people than America, but they had 8 million people as opposed to maybe close to a million. That's what I've heard that gathered in Washington on January 6th. So they are much more concerned. And unfortunately, what happened was that during those things, they had the same thing that happened on January 6th. They had infiltrators who started doing vandalism, and the protesters were trying to control these vandals, but it just got out of control, and they got separated from the vandals. It's like the army came in and took the law-abiding people away, left the Vandals there, and then they treated the law-abiding people that they separated from the Vandals as if they were like the Vandals. That's basically kind of what happened. And in the midst of that, I think this was prior to all of this happening in Brasilia. There was a pastor we mentioned before, Pastor Serere, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, a Christian pastor who was put in prison. And he's still in prison, and a story came out that he wrote a letter saying he supported Lula and he was against the protesters and stuff, but it's clear from the letter that that was either a coerced letter or a made-up letter that he didn't really write from prison, but he's still in prison. And he was in prison before Bolsonaro left Brazil, and that's a sign of his cowardice. If I had been Bolsonaro, I would have said, no, I'm not going to leave my people here and have, you know, people like this pastor who was fighting for me in support of me, you know, just go to prison and leave him, you know, rotting in jail while I go off to Florida. And the one thing I didn't mention before that's been in my thought is, what if Bolsonaro, I don't think he understands, he's coming to a country where election fraud is also acceptable. There's a regime in power that accepts electoral fraud that is friendly with Lula, and he comes here. How can he expect or be certain that he's not going to be extradited at some point and sent back to Brazil? So he's coming to take refuge with an ally of in a country that is controlled by the people who are allied with his enemy, and the enemy of the Brazilian people in Brazil. So who knows how long he will be here before he gets extradited if things don't get resolved correctly in Brazil. And I saw a letter, and I wanted to share this parts of the letter that came out. It's some sort of letter that a Brazilian, I don't know how he was able to post it, but he's one of the people who's been imprisoned, and I wanted to share parts of it. It says, I read it on the Gateway Pundit. If you look for something like "Cry for Help from Brazilian Concentration Camp," that's the title of it. Just shoot us and take us out of our misery. So this article talks about almost 1,200 political prisoners who have been taken to federal prison in Brasilia for, quote, terrorism. And this is an open letter that was able to, was sneaked out, you could say, from a Brazilian patriot, it says here, describing the evil set up on Sunday and horrendous conditions in Lula's concentration camp. I'm going to try to read parts of the letter. They're very sad. So this Brazilian wrote, "We are Brazilians who were betrayed by those who should be defending us. We went to the government quarter on Sunday not to break or destroy, because we're peaceful Christians, elderly people, women, children, indigenous people, and decent law-abiding men. We left our homes all over Brazil to come and defend our constitution." And that saddened me when I read that, because then I guess they don't... I guess I kind of understand him saying this because in Brazil, they don't have the worshiping of founding fathers in the Constitution that we have in America. But I guess within his limited understanding, he was trying to defend the truth. So, but it does bother me that he said that, defend our Constitution, which has been torn and trampled on by the Brazilian, quote, justice system, who released a criminal from prison, i.e. Lula, and had him elected. How can we accept a communist criminal in power if we didn't vote for him? We wanted to see the source code of the election software because we're pretty sure we've been robbed. Then came the persecution, the arrest, and torture of those who spoke out about the election fraud. We spent 70 days camped in front of the military headquarters because it was a way of protesting and we felt safe there. The armed forces embraced us, we thought. But then the persecution began. An Indian chief and pastor, José Acacio Serrera, Chavante. That's the person I was referring to earlier. And I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing the name. Was arrested and abused. Pastor Fabiano Oliveira and many others who are still in prison. But interesting. So two pastors. He mentioned this guy mentions two pastors, Christian pastors, and then that gets me to thinking. You know what a difference with America. We had the lockdowns. We've had all this fraud, all this stuff. And how many quote pastors have spoken out? Now, as we've said before, the fact that the church system is controlled by pastors is part of the problem with Christianity, not only in America but in general. And it has turned it into Christians in America and around the world are effeminate, very mild, and very stupid people in general, because they are controlled by a feminine personality, the personality of the pastor. They don't have the judge, the visionary, and the conqueror qualities that we have talked about, the male qualities. And as we said before, male and female, we're not talking about literal male, literal female. We're talking about functionality. So a female can act in male functionality, or a male can act in female functionality. And the Christian church is run by men, by women who pretend to be men. And I'm speaking figuratively here. They act like they are the authority, like manly authority, and they're just women. Very pathetic, effeminate women. So here in America, the quote pastors didn't do anything, haven't done really anything. Like that little bitch whore there are two that always come to my mind. One is Joel Osteen, that little effeminate whore who always preaches a very empty, superficial, fluffy message and nothing more. And there's no real transformational thought. And it's always geared towards improving your own life. It's never geared towards changing the world, changing circumstances. There's no transformational power. There's no conquering power. Yes, there's a limited conquering power, but it's always focused on how to benefit yourself. It's a very self-centered mentality. Joel Osteen didn't fight against anything. And another problem with the Christian American system is that the churches here have a tax-exempt status. And in order to preserve that status, they have to be apolitical. In other words, they cannot really say too many political things. But it's interesting to me that Democrats, especially black churches, get away with a lot of promotion of Democrats, especially Democrat politicians that go to speak to their churches and stuff. And they never seem to lose their tax-exempt status. But the thing is that Christian pastors try to shy away from, in America, from speaking out about things because of that status. And if I were one of them, I'd say to hell with that status. I'm not going to be a slave to anyone just for a few dollars. If they had principle, they would rather pay the extra tax than to have their independence be taken away from them. But most Christian pastors are effeminates, are cowards, are hypocrites, especially in America and around the world. And because of that, they don't speak out. So imagine in Brazil, you have pastors, and they are more than pastors. But these men are fighting. In America, we don't have any, like, T.D. Jakes, another little bitch whore down in Texas, I think, this black, worthless pastor who preaches a worthless message. He could have been such a strong voice to help transform black America. He did nothing. The worthless son of a bitch has been spending his life just serving himself. A worthless little bastard boy. And same with this other white boy in Texas, too, interestingly enough, Joel Osteen. and all these others in America. What a contrast between the Brazilian pastors and the American pastors. So I'm going to keep reading this letter from this Brazilian, this open letter. So it says, but the corrupt media that attacks us now never reported any of this. They sent the police several times to take us out and arrest us, but the armed forces did not allow it. People started to arrive from all over Brazil. By Sunday, we had more than 8 million people protesting in Brasilia. That's how I found out about the 8 million. We wanted to march to the federal district in Planalto, as we always did, in peace. And then, much to our surprise, hundreds of strangers showed up and joined us, wearing Brazil jerseys like we do. They started screaming and smashing their way into the federal buildings with sticks and weapons, breaking everything. We started screaming for them not to commit vandalism, but they didn't listen. To our surprise, some of these people were already inside the restricted areas and government buildings. How did they get in? Even police officers were breaking things. And we filmed it all. We have proof. So we ran back to the military headquarters, but the trap was expertly prepared. The corrupt left-wing press, who never reported about us or the persecution we experienced at the hands of the Supreme Court. And just as a note, in Brazil, I didn't know this, the Supreme Court has their own police force. So it's not like in America where you have these activist judges. I mean, they have it even worse in Brazil. The Supreme Court, the judges can enforce things and send the police to enforce things. They don't just decree, you know, verdicts in cases. They actually can send the police to arrest you and harass you. So it's even worse. The system in Brazil is even worse than in America. So it says here, the persecution we experienced at the hands of the Supreme Court and this illegitimate government started showing images of these communist infiltrators breaking everything. In other words, the corrupt left-wing press was exaggerating or emphasizing the vandalism. So he says, that was a plan, to be able to arrest us and call us terrorists. They are the real terrorists who were destroyed, set fire, and vandalized everything. We weren't just betrayed by the left, because we already knew that. The biggest betrayal was by the armed forces, because they live with all of us and know us and what we are like. And this kind of goes with what we've been saying, that the real problem in America is not the leftists. The leftists are trash. The leftists are lost. The leftists don't know what they're talking about. It's like talking to a deranged dog. There's no point in speaking with them. The problem in America is with conservatives, because they're closer to the truth, but they don't want to hear the whole truth. And because of that, the country is going to hell. And so the biggest betrayal is from the people who should be helping those who speak the truth. And the same thing is being reflected here in what he's saying. So he said, we returned to the camp and were shaken by what they were saying about us, calling us terrorists and threatening to arrest us. We are hardworking people, housewives, law-abiding citizens. Many were there with their families. We cry a lot. At night, we saw the army surround the base. We thought they would protect us from arrest. Some of the generals said they were going to a meeting and left. We tried to sleep at 7 a.m. on the 1st of January, the 9th of January. The base commander spoke to us with a megaphone and said, quote, you have 1 hour to dismantle the camp and vacate the area. Buses are waiting for you. Go in peace, unquote. We started to leave, sadly but orderly. When we got to the buses, we saw that they were not our buses, but we were forced to get on board. That's when we became prisoners. Then our torture began. They drove us around the city for almost 3 hours, showing us office trophies, just like a communist dictatorship. Almost everyone had to stand because there wasn't room for everyone to sit down. We let the elderly and wheelchair users sit and stayed standing. We asked them to stop the bus because people had to go to the bathroom, but they didn't respond, so people had to go to the bathroom right there. Sweaty, tired, and in pain, we arrived at the Federal Police Academy, where they put us in a gym with a room for not even 500. We were 1,600 people, packed like sardines. Many stayed on the patio. Outside, it was like a Nazi concentration camp. We suffered mental and physical torture because they didn't give us food and water all day. A lady died on Monday afternoon because she didn't get water. That night, a man died. Then they gave us bread and water. Elderly people, women, people in wheelchairs, children were separated from their parents and taken away. Can you imagine how their parents feel? We're being treated worse than criminals or dangerous drug smugglers. What kind of country is this? Where the real criminals are in government, starting with the new ministers, who each has at least 10 cases of corruption. Are we, who left our homes to fight for the freedom of our beloved Brazil, going to be left to suffer and die? Now they're going to send us to prison along with dangerous criminals. Maybe some will be released, probably the elderly. We will all be registered as terrorists. Our lives will be destroyed because we will never again be able to work or leave the country. Everyone's wondering, where are the conservative politicians? Where are the representatives of churches? Where is the Bar Association? Not even lawyers are getting through to us. Honestly, it would be better to shoot us now and take us out of our misery. When we pray, they tell us to shut up. The suffering is too great. And when we read here on the internet that they are calling us terrorists, it burns like a fire in our heart because everyone knows that we are not terrorists. Many conservative politicians are being cowards and condemning what we are accused of having done. And quote, and as a side note, that includes Bolsonaro, because there was another story that came out that Bolsonaro immediately condemned the vandalism, said everything has to be done by, I believe, in abiding by the law and the Constitution. So he was playing that same stupid card. They're saying, I want to do things the right way. I want to play nice. So Bolsonaro, the coward, was condemning the protesters and saying, no, you have to abide by the law and the Constitution. Yeah, like the very people who stole the election from you, right? They abided by the law, the Constitution. In fact, in this case, they used the Constitution. They used a side door through the Supreme Court. They had a guy in the Supreme Court who set free Lula and freed him from all the corruption charges so that he could run. So the Constitution is all messed up. They had a side door that they used, just like all the gaping holes we have in our Constitution. Brazil has their own gaping holes. They used it so that they could get this guy into the election, and then they stole the election. But Bolsonaro is still talking about abiding by the law and the Constitution. So not only Bolsonaro, many conservative politicians. I guess in his heart, this man was including Bolsonaro in his mind. He just didn't mention him by name. But it says here, but we did not do it. There are videos on the internet. In other words, we didn't do all this vandalism. There are videos on the internet. That was not us. So he says then, they know we're innocent. It was a setup. The videos are there to prove it, but they don't want to see that we are alone and abandoned. We have only God left. Most of us don't want to live any longer. And he put that in capital letters. In other words, he's shouting it. Most of us don't want to live any longer. And that's how I feel. I'll be very frank. You know, sometimes I'm sitting down and I'm saying, I don't want to live any longer. I'm just sick and tired of this. Sick and tired. It's like I threw my life away for the sake of a country that doesn't give a damn. Doesn't give a damn about the truth. And it's like, what's the point? Okay, so he says then, so we asked the world, the international human rights community, to help us. They have killed many of us, but none of this is reported. Many people have this innocent blood on their hands, especially the armed forces. You're genocidal. You used us as a cannon fodder. I hope you receive divine justice. Cowards. To the Brazilian armed forces, never again may you sing the Brazilian national anthem and fly our flag. You did not deserve it. And that's the end of the letter. And I'm sorry for reading the whole thing, but I believe it's important to share all of this. The deep struggle. And the thing with the armed forces, I believe, is that the armed forces was kind of maybe divided. But had Bolsonaro taken the part of the military that was ready to fight with him and for him and said, okay, let's do this, then he would have been able to do the reverse coup, and that's how I would call it, the coup to undo the coup, And once that had happened, I'm certain the rest of the army, the rest of the military would have followed, because they are followers. You know, the military is that has that problem. We've talked about that. We have that problem in America. And it, I think from America, it got spread out throughout the world, even though I do think it also was present in the world before America. So it's not all America's fault. But the militaries around the world have this tendency to emphasize submission to rank. You know, you do what your superiors tell you to do. You don't question it. And you get the psychological training, indoctrination, the hazing, and all the harassment that sergeants do, you know, that superiors do to the, you know, to the cadets, to the privates, to kind of force them into this mentality that you are to submit no matter how much of your individuality is taken away from you. So it's understandable that the military is now like, just doesn't know what to do anymore, and now they're just followers. They're within the system, a lot of them. But had Bolsonaro said we're going to do this, then he had enough people. You can read from the comments that a lot of the army were protecting these protesters from the police who were trying to attack them from the beginning. So the army was getting was on their side, but the problem is, you know, once the vandalism happened and all that, it is that the army just didn't know what to do and stupidly started to turn their backs on the protesters. But none of that dynamic would have happened if Bolsonaro had not been a non-Jordan crosser, if he had decided we are going to do this, if he had recognized the fact that our Brazilian system is flawed, just like the American system, it's flawed. And we need to change it. And we need, and this is a call for our nation to enter into a new system of government, a better, more democratic, more foolproof or corruption-proof system of government. Then he would have done that and things would have been different. But he cowered. And these are the consequences we have now. And now Brazil is in the state it's in. So, I don't know if I've already mentioned this, but Bolsonaro, at some point, there was a story that he was rushed to a hospital with a severe abdominal pain. And I haven't heard anything since then. I don't know what happened to him. But it's interesting that he was rushed to hospital with severe abdominal pain. And that was before this whole protesting thing became worse. So I believe it's almost divine judgment in a sense. I don't know what has happened to him since then. I haven't heard any story about that. So I guess he must have been okay, shall we say. But he did feel a little bit of that divine justice that this Brazilian was asking for at the end of the letter when he was saying, I hope you receive divine justice, cowards. And then Bolsonaro had to go to hospital with severe abdominal pain. And some people were saying in the comment section of that story, oh, they probably poisoned him. And who knows, maybe that's the thing. He's not safe here in America, not only because of the demon rats who will extradite him in a heartbeat, but because, you know, just like Castro would do, Brezhnev or Putin, you know, they send their people and they TCB, you know, they take care of business and they can poison him, do whatever they need to do to destroy him as a political enemy. So he's not safe anywhere. And the sad thing is he tried to distance himself so quickly from what was happening in Brazil. That's his fault that's happening like that. And he said, oh, I'm against all of that. As if to say, he was trying to set a precedent that he was against the vandalism so that in case he gets indicted for leading the terrorism, just like Trump was accused of inciting terrorism, then he's trying to cover his bases. But he doesn't even understand that that doesn't matter at all. If he gets extradited, it doesn't matter how many times he tweeted against the protesters who are fighting on his behalf. It doesn't matter. he's going to be sent off to jail and killed. He should have stayed in Brazil and said, you know, what's the point of living? I mean, what does he have to live for anymore? I mean, he should have just sacrificed his life. He said, okay, here I am. I'm going to fight it out till the end. If I have to end up in prison, so be it. And I would have understood him sending his family to Florida, his wife and his kids. You know, that's fine. Protect your family. But if I had been Bolsonaro, I would have stayed in Brazil and seen it through to the end, either ending up as a prisoner being tortured or being murdered or whatever. And it's sad because he survived an assassination attempt. So you would have thought that he had the mettle to do this, but apparently he didn't. And now we have the chaos in Brazil and the sadness. 8 million people. I mean, that tells you how easy it would have been to correct things if Bolsonaro had had the willingness to do it. But he did not want to cross the Jordan. And then he would have been reelected, been the president. And that presidency, it's like the Brazilian presidency ended. And it was ended in a kind of a suspension, because now the son of a bitch was there, the worthless little commie boy, Lula, that worthless bastard boy is not the real president. Just like Bite Me is not the real president here. So it's like the presidency has been suspended, and that's what's going on. So I wanted to talk about lastly about this Damar Hamlin, the young black player who had the heart attack and all that. I must say, and I didn't say previously, and it may sound like 2020 hindsight, but I am not lying when I'm saying this. I remember when I first saw the video clip of him doing the tackle, getting up and walking away, and then having the heart attack. When I saw him, there was something unclean about him. I can't quite put my finger on it. There was something unclean about him. Something wrong with him. And then I read the stories about how he's a very devout Christian who does all this community work and humanitarian work and all this stuff, and a very nice, well-spoken guy, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, well, maybe I misread him. And, you know, it was just one little, like a few seconds of him tackling a player. You know, how can you discern something like that? But I don't know. I just felt it. He felt unclean, very unclean. But I gave him the benefit of the doubt because of what everybody else was saying. And as we shared before, it got so intense, the support for him, that even on ESPN, which is a very liberal, anti-Christian network, there was this host, or I'm sorry, on the NFL Network, where they don't do this sort of thing. There was this host, sports host, who's in the middle of the show said, we need to pray for him. And he started praying live in the air, on air, praying to God for Damar Hamlin. And he didn't get fired or anything. But he boldly did it, and there's an image that I saw, a photograph of all the Buffalo Bills players kneeling, this time not against the national anthem, but kneeling in a circle on the field, and I guess that's when they were praying for him. I'm not sure, but that's the photo I saw. So it's like, okay, praying became popular, and people were praying for him and this and that. And he recovered miraculously. People are surprised. He should have been brain dead or permanently brain damaged, but he apparently, is back to normal, more or less. And the thing is that I saw they had a there was a story that that said something about how poetically perfect that the Buffalo Bills scored a touchdown on their opening kickoff in the next game. And so I clicked on the story, and it was the next game after the suspended game. Buffalo played against the New England Patriots. And apparently in the opening kickoff, Buffalo received the kickoff, and the guy who from Buffalo who received the kickoff ran it all the way back for a touchdown, which is not a very common thing. But it was like the very first play after the suspended game. And it was like, oh, you know, it's like almost as if people were saying God is on their side and look at them and so wonderful, blah, blah, blah. And they had a picture of Damar Hamlin in hospital with his two, I believe his parents, that's what they looked like, on either side of his bed. And apparently they were watching the game, and he was very excited about the game. I don't know if they were there at the moment when the game was being played. I'm not sure. The parents, I mean. But the thing is that he was watching the game from the hospital, and he saw the touchdown being returned by Buffalo, and he was excited, and that's understandable. And the thing is, he tweeted immediately when that happened. And I'm not going to say the four letters together. I refuse to do that because it's so disgusting to me. But I'm just going to try to give you an idea without saying the four letters in sequence, you know, one after the other. But he put the letter O, and then he put the letter M, and then he put the letter G. And in between the M and the G, he put the letter F. Now, I guess you know what, you know, the O and the M, and then, you know, people do that O and M and then the letter G. You know what that means, and I'm not going to say it. And then he put the letter F, in, you know, after the letter M. So you tell me what that F means, you know. Does it mean fearsome? Does it mean formidable? Does it mean fantastic? I don't think so. I don't think so. The worthless little son of a bitch who claims to be a Christian, and maybe he is technically a Christian, just used the F word in reference to you-know-who. Now, so let's say this is a miracle. Let's say if you believe in God and you think this was a miracle, okay. Let's assume that God miraculously rescued this man from certain death or permanent mental disability for the rest of his life. And his response immediately after being well is to use the F word. You see what I'm trying to say? You know, that doesn't come out of the lips of a person who is supposedly a good Christian. And that's when I saw that, yeah, that uncleanness that I saw in that video clip immediately, you know, immediately saw it whilst watching that video clip of when he got injured. That uncleanness is in him. He's an unclean guy. And the thing is, in the picture that they were showing from the hospital with his two parents on either side of the bed, they were all wearing this t-shirt that said, "Love for Damar." So I would dare say the parents are Christians too. Their faces, I don't know. Maybe they were, maybe they're not. But and even Damar, in you know, while lying on the bed, was wearing the Love for Damar shirt, which seems a little bit I don't know, egocentric, shall we say? But so the three of them were wearing this black Love for Damar t-shirt with white letters, Love for Damar. But wouldn't you think that if these people are Christian, especially Damar, that, first of all, I'm surprised how quickly they can print out those t-shirts nowadays. You know, back in the old days, that took weeks. You had to order them weeks in advance and stuff. And now, you know, it's like, I don't know, someone came up with that idea, let's do these t-shirts, and they got printed immediately. And the thing is that, if these people are Christian, especially Damar, don't you think that that they would have printed something like, "Thank you, God," or "God is amazing," or "God saved my life," "God healed me," or something like that. And thanks, you know, let's assume God exists, let's assume his God exists, and let's assume then that his faith is sincere, don't you think that would have been his natural reaction? To say to his God, thank you, God, for healing me. Thank you, God, for saving my life. Don't you think he would have done that? But he didn't. He said, love for Damar. It's like, me. The Black America thing. You know, that cannibalism and everything is for me. Just like that son of a bitch, T.D. Jakes, worthless bastard. Who lives for himself down in Texas. And could have done so much to help Black people, to speak to them, reach out to them. Never did. He's a multimillionaire living for himself. And he teaches basically the same message to every Black people. Just live for yourself. You know, me. So love for Damar, nothing of gratitude. And the only time he, and I could be wrong, I haven't heard anything from him officially. And maybe because I'm not following this in detail, but at least from the conservative websites, and a lot of them have a lot of like a Christian leaning, I think they would have jumped at the opportunity of posting some story where he is thanking God or saying, I praise my Lord and my God for having healed me. Maybe he said that, but it's been, if he said it, it was in such a low voice that I haven't heard it, and it hasn't been news anywhere. I've heard everybody praying for him. I've heard everybody, even there was a story that came out on this, on the Gateway Pundit, this conservative website that I go to read some headlines every now and then. And there was this story about how 24-year-old Damar Hamlin's collapse brought America together and reminded us about the importance of faith and prayer, you know, and it's like, oh, how wonderful. He brought us together and this and that. So all this warm and fuzzy Christian feeling is coming from everybody else, but I don't see it from him. And there's no gratitude in the son of a bitch who got healed by his God and then turns around and uses the F word in reference to you know whom. So and that tells me, there's no point in praying for this country. There's no point in praying for these people or interceding for them. If you're a Christian, there's no point. What is your point, you Christian, of praying for this country? This country's going to do a Damar Hamlin on your God immediately after recovering. And that's what they constantly do. And that's why I was saying before, I am no longer feeding hope into this country. Because every time this country is strengthened with my hope and the hope of others like me who seek the truth, then this country turns around with that strength received from our hope and turns around and attacks us, the very people who gave life, hope of life to her. You see what I'm saying? And this is exactly the same thing. And the other thing that I saw in that picture with his parents is he was doing that heart symbol with his hands. Like, I don't know what that means, or, you know, like love or something, but it's like what people do. It's like a popular hip thing. So I see the uncleanness in him. He's tweeting during football games. So he's into the social media and all this contamination that we have in our society nowadays, and that comes from a distorted pastoral, that comes from the pastors, too long to explain, but that contaminated communication comes from that. So he's into all that hip stuff and doing the heart sign and all that. So he likes to be popular and loved. That's why he goes into to do his humanitarian work, because it's a way of saying, hey, I do community service just like the liberals, you know, preach and things like that. But what's the point of that, all that humanitarian work? At the end of the day, it doesn't achieve anything other than this short-term relief of people. And let me say this very quickly. I know this audio clip has run very long, but let me just try to say very quickly. I live maybe how many blocks? Maybe it's literally one or two blocks at the most away from a church and that church has this kind of, I guess you can call it a soup kitchen or something like that, you know, where every now and then when I try to avoid that block because it feels very unclean. It's physically unclean and there's something unclean about that block. I avoid it. If you saw the block, I think you would know what I mean. But there's something unclean about it. So I avoid it. But every few times that I have been near it, I sometimes have seen this line of homeless people waiting in line to get in, you know, to their fed food, you know, by this so-called Christian church. And what I'm trying to say is, it's not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with feeding the poor. That's not what I'm saying. But the problem is, if you're a Christian, you're claiming, I mean, unless you're lying to yourself and lying to everybody else, you're claiming there's a God. I mean, otherwise, why establish a church with a building with a cross, you know, in the front? I mean, if you don't believe that there's a God, what the hell are you doing? You're just scamming everybody. But so you're claiming there's a God. You're claiming this God is the creator of the universe. So he must be a pretty powerful fellow, right? Now, this pretty powerful fellow is supposedly in, you are aligned with him. That's what you're claiming. If you're a member of this church, you're the pastor, whatever the hell they have there, then you're claiming that this God, who is very powerful, the creator of the universe, is there, and you're connected to him. And all these people are coming into your domain, your church building, to receive food and be in your presence, and in the presence of that very powerful God that you claim exists and that you claim to follow. Don't you think that after 1 or 2 or 3 weeks of going to that church to get food, at some point, a lot of these people wouldn't just get impacted by that invisible God you believe in? Don't you think they would start feeling something, a need to change? Because a lot of these people, and I say that from personal life because earlier in my life, I made an effort to help people like that. Believe you me. So I'm not speaking out of a heartless heart. It's not that I'm heartless and selfish. I went through that phase where I believed in helping people like that. And I realized with the passing of time that a lot of these people don't want to be helped in the sense that they want to stay in the position of being fed and supported, but they're not willing to do anything to change their lives in a permanent way. They are trapped in addictions, they're trapped in mental patterns, and I'm not talking about mental disease, that's a separate subject, but I'm talking about patterns of behavior in their minds and hearts that they don't want to change. They're comfortable living like that, and they don't want your help there. If you try to help them there, they say, get away, stay away from me, but give me my food, and then walk away, because I don't want your advice. Thank you very much. And there's no change in these people's lives, so they keep going to this church over and over again and get food provided to them, but there's no transformation in them. So they become this permanent underclass of parasites, of people who just don't do anything with their own lives, are not interested. And I do know there are exceptions. I do know there are exceptions. I know there are a few people out there that I wish I could just reach out and help. But they're so few and far between, it's very difficult to distinguish them sometimes. And those are the people that need to be uplifted. People who are really in a bad situation, who really, really need help, and who once they have received your help, they will try to get up on their own and have their lives transformed in a positive way. But the thing is, these people don't change. They're coming into the presence of this invisible God that these people claim to believe in and follow, and nothing happens. And all this humanitarian work is just like drops in the ocean. That's all it is. Drops in the ocean. It doesn't change the big picture because it never gets to the root of the problems. So it's just dealing with a little bit of on the surface, and it never ends. this poverty and purposeless lives just continue and continue and continue, and there's no change. None of these people get confronted when they go into that church building and feel the need, okay, I either shape up or get out of here. There's no sense of like, okay, you know, if I'm going to continue coming here to get food, I'll have to change my life because the conviction on me is so heavy, forcing me to change, that either I walk away from this building and never come back, or I change. You see what I'm trying to say? There's no transformation. If Christian humanitarian work is just like the work of any other non-Christian, then there is no difference between the one who claims to follow an invisible God and the one who doesn't. What's the difference? It's just humanitarian work. That's all it is. So all this Christian humanitarian work at the end of the day is nonsense. You see what I'm saying? So all this work that this guy is praised for is nonsense. It's at the end of the day nonsense. This guy has no understanding about anything. All he wants to be is popular and loved. He wants to feel, he probably doesn't feel comfortable, you know, becoming a liberal. So he kind of stays in, you know, straddling the fence between liberal, his liberal friends and buddies and his so-called Christianity. And a way to reconcile them both is doing humanitarian work, so that he looks like, oh, he's a selfless person who does all this extra community work. And that makes him look cool and popular and loved by the liberals. But he would never be willing to confront his fellow black brothers and sisters about what's wrong in the black culture. No, he would never do that. So he's never going to target the root of the issue. So he's working in this system that keeps feeding people who get strengthened and then turn around and attack the very people who strengthen them. Just like all these, you know, derelicts, all these people who go to these soup kitchens and get fed and then turn around and do drugs and do a lot of things that would be considered contrary to, quote, Christianity. And they come back as if nothing had happened to get another bite of food. And that has to stop. And that's why America, you're on your way to die. You have between less than eight or nine months left. And I don't give a damn. I couldn't care less. Go ahead and die. I'm not going to give you any more hope. Neither I nor the people who believe in the truth are going to give you any more hope. You deserve to die. Go ahead. Make my day. Die off. You worthless bitch. Die off. This is what I wanted to share, and I guess in essence, this is all very sad because we were playing a great game, and we were on the verge of getting over the hump and completing the journey, America's wonderful journey, or tortured journey, shall we say, might be a better expression, and we never completed it. We fell short of the goal line, just like the Tennessee Titans when they played in that Super Bowl where they fell short by 1 yard. I don't think we even came within 1 yard. I think we were beyond midfield. We didn't even get close to the end zone, but at least we were in the neighborhood and we could have done it, and we chose not to do it. And the game got permanently suspended, and we became Buffaloes and Cincinnati's that never got over the hump and won the big game, the game we needed to win. And we've had all these cowards, these non-Jordan crossers who kept us from, as a people, you know, getting our feet into the water and crossing it. We had our own versions of Bolsonaro and other people like that. And people who ended up betraying the ones who were willing to risk their lives and cross the river Jordan to get to the promised land. And that's the story. I had to live my life through a period where we we played a game that got suspended, permanently suspended, and never completed. And that will be the story of America, the country that had the promise and didn't fulfill it permanently. And we will become just a more anglicized version of Latin America, but nothing better than that. And as I said, we have 8 to 9 months left. I believe I have a date in my mind, and I'll share it with you, I guess, when we get to that date. I hope to be alive by then as well to share it with you. And that's when I believe America will be officially dead and become a third world country. It won't happen, you know, the transformation will happen immediately, but it's like at that moment it's over. From then on, it's just a decline towards that, the completion of the decline towards that. But we are officially a third world country. There's no more hope for us after that date. But I treat the country as if it were dead. It's like, as I've said before, it's like you're watching a game, let's say an American football game. The score is 72-0 late in the third quarter, beginning of the fourth quarter. There's no chance in hell or heaven that your team is going to win. There's no chance. 72-0. And you're rooting, supporting a team of inept players who never take risks, who never listen to the truth beyond their comfort zone. So there's no chance that a miracle can be done through them. So it's just, we're just waiting for the clock to run out, just for the score to be official, to say the game is finally over. Because that's ironic. Even though the game of our country was suspended permanently, never finished, the game that marks the demise of us as a people, as a country, of any relevant future, that game will conclude and has and I'm just waiting for it to run out. I'm no longer hoping or interceding for you, America. Yeah, I'm just waiting for the clock to run out to make it official. The game is over. The score, I don't know, the other team's going to run up the score even more. But right now, it's 72-0, and we'll just have to make it official. And when that happens, then I know, okay, that's the end of this country. And I have no idea where to go from there. We'll see what happens. And things are going to get worse and worse for the people who are seeking the truth, just like what's happened with the Brazilians who tried to fight for the freedom of Brazil. Now they're in prison camps, and now they're being attacked and tortured because the system is just going to become more openly contrary to anyone who says anything close to the truth. So the country is going to become increasingly more dangerous and more difficult to live in, even more than it has become now. I think Americans just don't understand where we're heading. Americans just don't understand what it means that the country will be dead. They are not aware of it. And that day will come and go, and most people will probably not even have a clue of what happened. But the country is going to be dead then. It's practically dead now, but we just have to wait for the clock to run out. Thank you very much for listening.